You are grown-ups, and you are welcome to stand up and do whatever you want to do, but I do believe we have about 10 minutes before, 11:15, I think, is the bishop's time, and I think you will definitely need a break and a stretch between now and then. I am happy to take some questions. I'm happy to do that. So let's take a few just publicly. If you want to get up and move, don't be shy. And then if it gets to the point where I think we should just end the formal questions, I'll just stand here and you can come on up. So in the back. Right. She's asking a question, a very good question, about what about work? What about that place we spend our time? It should be in the ecology, I would call it, of everyday life and life-wide framework formation. One of the things that I'm fascinated by, this is just a sidebar, Europe has a longer tradition than we do of industrial chaplains, and that practice is beginning to catch on in this country again. And there are people who are called into ordained ministry and feel themselves called to being what's called an industrial chaplain. People who see their work, and big corporations are hiring them to be present to people in work settings. They're part ethicist, part pastor, part confessor. They are part, conflict mediator. There's a whole lot of ministry that goes on. In terms of how work fits into what I've been trying to talk to you about these last couple days, I would say the mistake we make that is the costliest one, I think, around formation of whole people is the silence is our silence about people's public the people's lives beyond the church. Too often we imply with our silence that people who are very competent in the worlds that they occupy in their employment should sort of park that at the door and come into church and live in a domain where they're much less confident. So we have people on vestries who are extraordinarily gifted in their profession. And we do often forget to draw from the wisdom of those professions, and we suddenly put them on committees or give them jobs that are not in their wheelhouse, that are not speaking to that. So if you have a physician on your vestry, what could she or he offer about end-of-life wisdom for a congregation that is aging, right? What could people who are working in law enforcement help us understand about what's unfolding in Baltimore and other parts of this country? What could people do who know something about hourly work and trying to survive help us understand about the working poor? How do we bring that wisdom and expertise into our common life? And then equally, how do we nurture the spirituality of the workplace for people? There are some people who have the luxury of sitting at work or having work time where they can actually look online while they're at work. And there are a number of lovely websites that offer brief meditative practices, prayers, a reminder in the midst of your busy workday that you are, in fact, a person of faith and this is a nurturing space. There's other jobs that won't allow that, right? I mean, you legally can't do it, or you simply can't stop what you're doing to watch a quiet meditation or listen to some music. But there are tools we can give people. I teach people the breath prayer often, and that is a tool that's portable that can go to wherever they travel in work. And I encourage people to use that as an exercise of calming and centering in the midst of their daily work, and then to go home and journal or write about it or tell me what it was like to use that prayer in that form. But I think you're absolutely right. Work is where we spend a lot of our time. I would like to help people see that home, whatever home is, needs to be also a sacred space. And too often our home is simply the place that we throw our stuff down, grab a bite to eat, and crash. And I want that to become a more reverent, sacred space. Whatever the size and scale of it, it can be a holy space. We can learn that from the Buddhists. They have, shrines in their houses. We could do better. Question? Yes. Right.
It was sort of written in a negative.
Yeah, it's a double negative, right.
Could you explain that? Because I was trying to understand if people thought their worship was well done,
right.
Yet it was not.
Right. What this is so people were asked to describe their, in survey, they were asked to describe their worship and say, it accomplishes these things very well. I mean, it was actually a Likert scale, you know, when it's like 1 to 7 or 1 to 5, from not at all to very much, right? So what they found was that in Episcopal congregations, 4% of the respondents said that their congregation, the worship in their congregation was innovative.
And did it very well.
And did it very well. 17% said it was inspirational and did it very well. Those were the criteria were inspirate, right? And 23% said they did thought-provoking very well. So thought-provoking makes sense, right? We are a church that challenges with reason and so forth. I think you could mine that a little bit, and I think that would be very, depending on the educational level of the people in the pews or the chairs, I think thought-provoking varies a lot. But yeah, that's what that is. Yes.
I'm wondering what's going on with the other half. Why are the other half that are innovating?
Well, thriving, it's called spiritual vitality. So this goes back, I would put this together with the work that they did from the Reveal study from Willow Creek. They look, the churches that are perhaps innovative and contemporary may actually be fiscally stable. They may be sound right now. But when you scratch below the surface, what this research suggests, not necessarily accurately, but I think pretty suggestively, is that people are not growing. The spiritual vitality, that what's going is the club. The club is working really well. We're doing music really nicely. We're doing, you know, we've got the right programs to keep our parents happy for our kids. We've got stuff happening, but when you actually ask, is it spiritually vital? People are not getting closer to God because they're coming to church on a regular basis in the same way. They're meeting the people they want to meet. You know, it's the right place to be on a Sunday morning or whenever they participate. But it's that huge number of our congregations that are static, I would say, when it comes to transforming lives. And the dilemma is, where will they be in 10 years? Because if it is not, if this is accurate, if it's not spiritually vital now, those who are only there because parents literally expect them to be there, or because their bodies are well enough for them to be there, will not be there in 10 years. And so then we really have to say, how are we replacing, if we're not passing on faith that is substantive, is the next generation going to be as generous financially? Is it going to be as generous with their time? And I would suspect not. Owned faith.
And owned faith, you'll find that participants at that level sort of move to the fringes or the outskirts where they're actively involved in mission, outreach, they're doing service.
Right. She's asking about owned faith, which is the fourth style of faith John Westerhoff identified as the one that has been through searching faith and come to their own claims on faith. I did say, in many cases, people who have a mature owned faith in that sense of expression are often on the perimeters of our churches because they're just fed up with the mundane. They're out doing the work because when you have own faith, you can't help but want to be engaged in it. Not all. Many core leaders are people of deep own faith. So you will have some people, I'm sure, in your churches and congregations that are faithfully articulate about their faith and giving back in immediate internal ways. But they're also people, they're also likely people who are quietly tithing. They're also likely people who give of their time in places other than the church when it's needed. They're also likely people who are looked to within their extended family as a person of trusted integrity. You know, they're a person who people turn to. They're an elder. They're not necessarily old, but they have the wisdom of elders. They're people who have, you just know them by their being, right? Is that helpful, Kim?
Well, the real question is, since we fall short when we choose people for leadership positions that are not quite at that mature level, how do we develop formation that will invite people to be as enthusiastic about serving internally
right.
as they are externally?
Is No, she's not. I think there's two parts to that, at least. I think there's a structural piece, and there's a formation pastoral relational piece. Do you guys remember the early study in congregational development a long time ago? Kenneth Callahan, who's an early congregational developer, talked about the difference between functional and relational dynamics in a congregation. And what he discovered, and I think it's very helpful, is that the functional dynamics in a congregation are the infrastructure, the things that have to happen to make a congregation work, right? It's the building, the lights, the sidewalk, you know, the parking lot, the quality of coffee, the signage. It's the, you know, the trains running on time. It's the stuff that makes church be church physically. The relational are all those qualities of congregational life that have to do with interpersonal relationships and relationships with God. What Kenneth figured out is that satisfaction comes with a high degree of relational effectiveness. You cannot improve dissatisfaction by attending only to the functional. So when people are cranky and they're complaining, and they've got all sorts of reasons that they're unhappy with life at church, you can make things physically better. You can improve lighting. You can improve the parking lot. You can improve all those things. But their level of satisfaction with the life of your church will only improve because you work on the relational. So when you ask the question, how do we help more people move towards owned faith, if that's a helpful model, and at the same time develop a commitment to the parish, I think we have to think about the functional structures that we're asking them to engage in. I think committees are not necessarily life-giving experiences for most of us. So I think we need to jettison more committees than we have historically jettisoned. Why does everything that happens in a church have to be a committee process? Why can't we have a discernment process that says, this person who's got a great idea is not crazy. She has the capacity to recruit some core people to do it. We have the resources. Go! You know, do this. We need to give people more freedom to be able to trust that their maturing faith has the capacity to discern the needs of the congregation, the neighborhood, the community, whatever. We need to be more transparent about what has to get done, and be more willing to let some things not get done. We have to be less afraid as clergy leaders and core professional leaders that if something fails, it's not just our fault. So part of it is giving people the respect that they are fully adult, capable, or young, capable of playing the piano when they're 4 years old in Sunday school and then doing something equivalent when they are 17 or 25 or 45. It's that piece I put about experiential learning, giving people feedback about what you see their gifts being and how you see their gifts growing so that they can help you say, then I want to apply them to something new. It's work, there's no question. I have had a lot of success giving this wedge model to my vestries that I've worked with so that they can help each other. They can self-diagnose where they're stuck and what they need. So it's not all about the priest doing the work. Dorothy. That's good. So she's saying we need to remember that we are sacred space and that's at the core of being able to offer people a relationship with God that is transformative, right? Yeah. So, and that's the work we have to do. And we all know, I mean, I'm preaching the choir here too, right? I mean, we have to be spiritually healthy in order to help form anybody else's faith. I need to be honest about my own and I need to be in the discipline and practice of my own prayer, my own study, my own Sabbath, right? Two more, and then we're going to take a break.
Okay. Do you have the source of the Westerhoff?
Yes. Will Our Children Have Faith is the little book that he wrote in 1976. It's still published. It's still available. And he will talk in that about, he was doing it from the perspective of rethinking how we do Christian education with children. But the model is in there. And then there's another book by Don Kimball, spelled like my last name. Power and something that's out of print, but you can find it. And Don Kimball was a Roman Catholic priest who has since been defrocked, unfortunately, but he did some really good work with Westerhoff's model, and he's the one that introduced me to the wedge, and then I've since played with it further. But so if you find those two books, and they're both very readable, you'll be in good shape. Something in Power, I'll think of it. Power and Authority, is that it? I think that is it. It's pink or red. Anyway, can you tell I'm a Myers-Briggs N, I'm not a Myers-Briggs S? Like, yeah, it's a book, it's sort of like, it's out there, yeah. But his name is Don Kimball, and you'd find it. I said two more questions, and there was a hand. Yes?
When Andrew Rood at Luther Seminary talks about the nuns and the millennials, yeah, and all of those, and this supposed hostility or whatever, something against the church, he says it's not the case, they were not even on their radar screen. So where does evangelism fit in to this model of faith formation?
Okay, this is another two-hour question. No, it's a great question. The question was, she was referring to Andy Root, who is at Luther Seminary and has done a lot of work on evangelism and relational ministry in particular. And she's saying, and accurately, that he points out, as many of you know already, that the nuns, you know, it's not that they're waiting for us to ask them to come back, right? They're just really not interested. They're completely disinterested. And I would add that them to the demographic of people who are religiously very illiterate. I mean, they don't really know much about any religious tradition, certainly not their own if they were of any kind of Christian heritage. And the reality is they don't seem to care a whole lot. She's asking, where does evangelism fit into that? I wish I had like a one-line answer, but what I will say is, I'm just going to personalize it. I don't think I have any business teaching seminarians at VTS about passing on faith in their congregations and communities they will serve, if I myself am not in some way trying to practice that myself. So I think part of it is we need to be in the world where we're engaging with people like that who are real human beings. So if you're fortunate to be a parent or a grandparent of kids who are playing soccer, go to a soccer game. Hang out on the sidelines, talk to people, listen to their stories. Let them, you know, find out that you're a church geek. Let them find out what you do. Let them ask the questions they ask, or those people on the airplane that we all sort of want to avoid but actually probably should be listening to, right? Figure out what time in your life and week you are actually open to knowing something about people who would, on these scales, measure as a nun. And I've been as bold as to say to people like that, what's your advice for me? You know, I'm a person whose salary is paid by the church. I'm kind of an insider. You know, I'm doing this. You know, I can tell you I believe it, but that obviously isn't what you want to hear right now. I just want you to say, what's your advice? And to a last person, what they say is, I want the church to make a difference in the world. I want the church to act on what you say you believe. And I want the church to make the world a better place. So my sense of the evangelism is that we need to do the work we're called to do, which means we need to be addressing violence. We need to be addressing racism. We need to be addressing economic injustice. We need to be known, and bravely so, for taking a stand on issues that are difficult. Now, we can't all take them on all of them. We don't all feel called to do that. But those of you with collars, you need to wear your collars in places of public witness. And those of us who don't wear collars, we need to be willing to say, I'm here because Jesus wants me here. And we need to sound more like those people that many of us kind of ran away from at some point in our early childhood. So the simple answer is, it's hard work. I think the arrogant answer is, oh, if we just do it better, they'll come. I think we need to be changed by them more than they initially will be changed by us.
But the other part of that,
yes,
is that a lot of us are not aware of how much the Episcopal Church really is doing,
exactly,
to make the world a better place.
Right.
And so part of it is, do we need to do more of that, making the,
right,
world a better place? Of course we do.
Right.
The other part is,
tell the stories of what we're doing. No, I couldn't agree more. That's where the social media piece for me, for example, I mean, I keep calling about e-formation, but that whole first day, well, there will be a whole thread in that day for people who want it about how to use social media for social change, like for, and so how do you tell the stories of your local congregation or your own work or other people to audiences who will not hear it in the building, will not read your bulletin, will not read your newsletter, but will hear it on Twitter, you know? How do you do that? And not in any way not tell the truth. You're telling exactly what you're doing. It's inspiring to people when we land in their zone of proximity. So thank you for saying that. Yeah, I do want to end because you need a break, but thank you so much.